Welcome to the Sober Yoga Girl podcast with Alex McRobbs, international yoga teacher and sober coach. I broke up with booze for good in 2019, and now I'm here to help others do the same. You're not alone, and a sober life can be fun and fulfilling. Let me show you how. So welcome back to another episode of Sober Yoga Girl. I have Graham with me on the show today, and Graham is from the north of England. He is someone who has been through alcohol addiction, has recovered, and is happy to share his story with others. So thank you so much for being on the show today, and welcome, Graham. How are you?
Thanks very much. Yeah, big honor. Thank you. Pleasure's mine. Yeah, I'm fine, thanks.
Good.
Oh, good. Thank you. We've got nice weather in the UK for the change. Yeah, everyone's happy.
I've heard it's nice. Finally. So why don't we start off and you can tell me a bit about sort of your background, your story, kind of who you are and where you're from.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, well, my name's Graham. I grew up in the northwest of England, in between the two big cities in the northwest. That's Manchester and Liverpool. So I grew up in an industrial town called Warrington, right in the middle. 50 years of age, I have one son, aged 26. His name's Callum. And yeah, for the long time, I would say right through my 20s and all the way through my 30s, I was battling really bad alcoholism. And I'm lucky enough to have come out the other end.
So tell me about sort of how your drinking began. When did you start drinking?
Well, when I started socialising, I was about 18 or 19. Mm-hmm. I wasn't a big drinker at first. It was more into the acid house scene. And that's a big thing in the north of England. The youth culture then was to go to big acid house parties, and it was taking ecstasy tablets and recreational drugs. It wasn't really centred on drinking. So I didn't really start heavy drinking until my early 20s, I'd say. When I started going out with people from the work, I was introduced to all day drinking, I'd say, when it was about 20 or 21. And I just got the taste for it. I just got the taste for being around a lot of men, sitting in working class pubs. I was into the football culture, you know, watching football, getting drunk. And it just grew from there. I just, you know, in love with the effect of alcohol until I became dependent on it.
When did that, so you started drinking around age 18. How did that progress over time? Like, tell me about what that was like.
I wouldn't say heavy drinking at 18. I would say that heavy drinking started when I was about 20 or 21, when I started hanging around with older men. Because I worked in Manchester at the time, at a big warehouse, a really working class environment where everyone socialised together as well, even not only worked together. It was like one big family. We went out together after work, and we hung out at weekends with the same people. And in that part of the world, Salford and Manchester, it's a big thing going out all day drinking. That's meeting at midday and drinking all the way through, right, maybe till 2 o'clock in the morning. So it's like going to all the pubs all around Manchester and then going to a club afterwards.
Yeah.
And not only that, on the Sunday, the next day, meeting the pub again on the Sunday, and you start again. And I really loved it. Because at that time, it was young and exciting. And I was, you know, it was like a new, I didn't think I'd be doing it forever. I just thought, I'm young and I'm not doing any harm. And I really bought into that lifestyle of going out and getting drunk and enjoying myself. And it was the start of the 1990s, which was a really hedonistic decade, where going out and getting drunk was, it wasn't really frowned upon. It's more, it's encouraged, especially by the media and entertainment industry. And if you think as well, at the time, Manchester was the centre of the universe. It's where the big Manchester scene, where, you know, the nightclubs and the bands like the Stone Roses, Happy Mondays, you know, it was before Oasis, but, you know, Manchester at the time was at the centre of the universe. It was even more cool than London at the time. So now, and I was right in the middle of it all as a young man.
Yeah.
So everyone just wanted to party all the time and be out.
I mean, can you hear how you can get swept up in that, you know, like the people who
you're with.
Yeah, definitely. When I was young, my drinking as well started, you know, as like partying with friends and fun and university.
Yeah, yeah. It is fun when you're doing it, isn't it? It's like you think, oh, I don't want these times to end.
interesting what you mentioned about how it's a big thing in the UK to start drinking in the middle of the afternoon and then keep going. Because in Canada, that wasn't so much a thing when I was there that I was aware of. But in Abu Dhabi, it's really common. They call it brunches, where people start drinking at like 1 p.m. And I think it's I think there's a really big British influence here. I wonder if that could be the connection, because I had never heard that before, but that makes kind of sense with what happens here.
It depends on the people that you're mixing with and what kind of circles you're moving in. I was mixing with a lot of working class people who, you know, all bets were off. As soon as you had that first drink, there's no rules. You stayed out. If you had the money and the finance, you stayed out. And at the time, I had no children, no mortgage or no real responsibilities. All my wages were mine. And yeah, bring it on. We was out till all hours and there's no rules. There's no going home and getting changed and coming back out. Once he was out, we was out.
Yeah. And so when did it start to shift for you to be problematic?
I would say as early as my mid-20s, I'd say. Mm-hmm. My hangovers got worse. I started feeling rough in work and my performance at work just went downhill. I was coming in work and just bluffing the day, just watching the clock, because the effects of alcohol was starting to hit me. I was smoking tobacco as well, which smoking and drinking, my body just didn't like it, like the pair of them. It was affecting my health badly coming here. No, right from my early 20s.
Yeah. And then what was like the moment or what made you eventually have to stop, or how did you sort of hit that point?
I wanted to stop from my mid-20s. I remember at the time, I was 24 when my partner at the time was pregnant with my son, and I said, that's it, I'm quitting drinking when my boy comes. I'm quitting drinking and quitting smoking. And I'm going to be a good father, a good role model, and I just couldn't do it.
Yeah.
I didn't quit drinking until I was 40.
Wow.
So I was battling alcoholism. I wanted to quit for 20 years.
Wow.
I wanted to stop, and I just couldn't do it.
Wow.
The pull of alcohol.
Yeah.
Was too much for me.
And so how did you finally quit?
I had a couple of, towards my late 30s, it was affecting my health badly, where there's having to have hospital visits, so having to have medical detoxes. That's where they put you in a hospital bed, they put a drip inside you, and they feed you up full of vitamins and drugs, you know, to get you through the withdrawals. And I started having them kind of experiences, and it got worse. I had to have stays in psychiatric wards because I was seeing things and getting voices in my head. It was really bad. And I had a couple of bad visits where I was seeing spirits, or seeing things, or getting visits and things from entities warning me. And the last visit I had, I remembered it was February in 2011. It was a really bad visit. And from then, I've not touched a drop. That's 10 years ago.
Wow. And what was different about that final sort of experience? Like, what was it that really, like, ended it for you?
Good question. I don't know. It's just pure surrender, getting on my knees and reaching out to the spirit world and the higher powers that are out there that look after us. I just said, look at this, I can't beat this.
Yeah.
This thing's got me. I keep trying to quit, it keeps drawing me back in. And these spirits are saying, you want to get your act together, smarten your act up. They more or less said, you've got the capability of being a leader of men, and you're wasting your life, and you're a broken person. You're a failed unit, you know what I mean? And I could see it was affecting my father's health and my mum's health. It was like affecting everybody. And from that last binge, that last hospital stay, it's just stayed off it. I've just turned into something else.
And so when you, what helped you in this transition time, like keeping your sobriety, staying sober? Did you go to AA? Did you?
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
I found AA helpful. It's not for everybody, AA, but I used it as a tool. to my advantage. The AA thing, it gets a lot of bad press, but if you use it to actually stay sober, a lot of people go there and they think their life's going to change overnight and they're going to meet loads of great new people and their life's going to change. That's not what AA is all about. You go to AA because you're not well, and there's other people there that are not well either, you know. And I'll always remember turning up at AA, and I used to listen to people's stories, and there's groups of women there, and one woman come up to me and she says, "You don't seem happy." And I says, "Well, I'm not. I'm just recovering from alcoholism. I'm not here to have fun. I'm here to get better." And she, you know, any kind of group dynamic, you have cliques, people that you don't like, and that's why people don't last at AA, because you go to AA, there's groups of people, there's cliques, like any group dynamic. I didn't go there to make new friends. I went there to stay sober and to digest other people's experiences. Serious stuff, not there to make new friends. It was there to get well and stay well.
Yeah.
And that's how I worked the AA. There's guys there who've been sober for 20 odd years, Glaswegian guys, who I would happily paid £50 an hour to listen to, who were that funny and that charismatic, and the stories were that good. And I was taking on these stories and I was digesting them, ignoring all the nonsense. I'm just focusing on, well, you focus on the good people that go, because when you, every AA, there'll always be a good person there who's, you can learn a lot from, and that's what I did.
Yeah. And, you know, I think there are so many, like, amazing resources out there, and there's, I'm a big believer in, like, you know, do what works for you, right? And so for myself, I didn't go to AA, but I don't think that there's anything wrong with AA. And I think that, you know, using, drawing upon whatever resources work and inspire you, like if that worked for you, then that's amazing, you know?
Yeah, it was eye-opening, because at the time I was living in Manchester. I don't know what you know about Manchester. Manchester's a big city in the north of England, a big industrial city. It's got a very big working class population. You call it blue collar, they're over in the States. You call it blue collar. You know, a lot of people on, say, low incomes, you know. Right. And in them kind of areas, you have a lot of tough people, a lot of people suffering addiction as well because of the poverty and stuff like that. And a lot of them AA meetings were around tough, really tough people. You know, these weren't fluffy people. These were really rough around the edges people that were in there. And it, you know, taught me a lot.
Yeah. What was one of, like, the biggest insights or takeaways from AA?
A lot of things. Well, is to stay away from that first drink, because it's the first drink that gets you drunk, not the 10th one or the 12th one. Because if you don't have that first drink, you won't have the 12th one.
Yeah.
So that's one of the biggest ones. Just really poignant sentences, like the Scottish guy used to say, "This alcohol, don't underestimate how alcohol is powerful stuff." That's a short sentence with so much meaning, so much power. It is powerful stuff. It's not just the drink. It's one drink could set you on the road to absolute destruction. This guy had been off the drink for 3 years, and he's with his family on New Year's Eve. You know, he's won his family back. Everyone was happy. He was off the drink. And it was like 1 minute to 12 o'clock. And this is a Scottish guy where New Year in Scotland's a big thing. Okay. He said, "I'll just have one whiskey at midnight to celebrate New Year, and that's all it'll be, one whiskey, okay?" He said this to his wife. That one drink of whiskey lasted 9 years.
Wow.
And during those 9 years, he lost 2 jobs. There was 3 suicide attempts.
Oh, my goodness.
His wife divorced him. He lost his home. He ended up homeless, living at his sister's, on benefits, everything ruined. Because he decided to sit that one drink at midnight. That's a powerful story, you know. It's true as well. It's not like it's not a Hollywood story. It's a true story.
And you remember these stories forever, and they can change.
Yeah.
They can change you.
Of course, yeah. And that's why I went to AA, to listen to these stories. You know, it's not just me. It's gone through that. Don't get me wrong. I tried to clean up. Dozens of times I went months without drinking and got myself back into work and got my finances in order and rebuilt relationships with the girls that I was with, and everything seemed to go fine, but it always drew me back. I always thought I was cured of it. I always thought, I've not drank now for 3 months, and this time it'll be different. This time I'll only drink weekends. Before you know it, within 2 weeks, I'm back in the hospital bed.
You've been through so much.
Yes, but I'm also very lucky as well. A lot of my friends have not made it.
Yeah. Tell me about, like, AA was one tool that helped you in your recovery. And you also mentioned that you're, you know, very spiritual now and you're a Reiki practitioner. Is that a tool that helped you in your recovery as well?
I'm not a practitioner. I go for Reiki sessions myself. I wish I were. Maybe in the future. The spiritual side of things is quite recent, to be honest with you, where I started reaching out to spiritual people. I've had spiritual experiences, but I didn't think about becoming spiritual myself, you know, until maybe the last year or so, where I started reaching out to people that practice meditation and yoga and things like that, and start talking to them, because I just got to go to the next stage. Okay, I've quit alcohol 10 years ago and I quit smoking 4 years ago. And I just wanted to elevate from being a normal person to being a great person.
Yeah.
But I just didn't feel I had the energy. I just thought I had only had the energy to do okay at my job, come home from work tired, and then do bits and go to sleep and groundhog day, go back to my job again. I was thinking, I want more than that. I want to become a great person. But how do I do it? Because at the moment, I just feel like I'm just doing my job, going to work. So I started speaking to people. People that call themselves 5D people, you know, people have ascended to five-dimensional kind of things, teaching. And they simply said, if you want to improve your energy, you need to open your heart. Which at the time I didn't realise it, but I had a closed heart. I didn't really have much empathy for people, for poor people or people going through a bad time. More or less, I wasn't cruel about it, but just maybe as a swept away thinking, if you're poor, it's your own fault, that kind of thing, which is not the case. I've since learned that is not the case. Yeah. And I started learning to open up my heart and stop listening to what we're told on the TV and stuff like that. And that's opened up a whole new world for me. Started accepting friends from Africa on my Facebook and making contact in Uganda, but started sending aid over there and clothes. Now, stopped wearing designer clothes myself, threw away all my designer clothes, and sent them to Africa, to be honest with you, but I just wear linen clothes now. I don't wear anything that's got a fashion label on it anymore. And I've got links in remote villages in Uganda where I regularly send aid, food, baby clothes, baby consumables, stuff for single mothers. And that's carried on. That's lit me up, really lit me up.
It sounds like it's given you a lot of meaning in, like, helping others.
Yeah, definitely. It's just opened up a new dimension to my existence, you know, and I've got a lot of footage. You see, I've got good contact in Uganda now. When I send the stuff, I get videos sent back to me, photographs showing what I've sent and showing the people eating the food and opening the bags of sweets and wearing the clothes. And I show it to people in my community, people that donated to me. I put it on Facebook. Look at this. Your donations are actually reaching the people that need it, rather than it's disappearing down a black hole. I'm actually showing you where your stuff's going. I'm showing you the children's faces light up when they're opening up the sweets. Because imagine in Uganda, a remote village, don't have sweet shops, or they don't have 24/7s or service stations. The remote areas, a lot of poverty. They don't have benefit frameworks like we do in the UK.
Right. And so they really benefit from any kind of help that can be
absolutely. You have nothing, because I'm not going to get political because I'm not a political person, but the Uganda, the economy over there is shot to pieces. They've got a president over there which get the impression doesn't really care much about the poor. It's like a wealthy elite that live in Uganda. There's not much done to improve conditions for people living in hardship. So that's not my fight. My fight is to get the stuff over there to the kids and the mothers that need the stuff. The political fight, that's up for other people. That's not my area. So
Just caring for others in like the best way.
Yeah.
If you can.
And it's from there as well. It's not just a Facebook vanity project wanting likes. It's like, it's I'm feeling it there. You know what I mean? I'm feeling like these kids are mine.
Wow.
You know what I mean? And I'm feeling like the mothers over there and my sisters, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Really connecting with them as if they're my family. And it's 5 years ago, you know what I mean? I wouldn't have thought that. I was just going to say, especially in the UK, you're more or less taught, it's like a rat race in the UK. It's more or less taught, look after yourself, do better than your neighbour. You know what I mean? It's like, there's a culture over there where we're directed to look down on the poor in the UK. You know what I mean? If someone's claiming benefits or they've not done well in life, then more or less we're channeled to look down on people like that. And in the past, I've been guilty of soaking that up.
Yeah.
You know, but the mindset's got to change. If anyone's poor, no matter if they relate to you or not, or living in another country, we should all be working together to stop poverty.
Yeah, absolutely. And so if people want to get involved and contribute to your project in Uganda, how do you collect funds for that?
I've done a couple of Facebook campaigns.
Okay.
Where I've told people, you know, my last campaign, I sent a pallet of shoeboxes for kids. I've got one here. This is the idea. This is a shoebox full of sweets and a toy in it. Okay. And maybe some pens and pencils. So I asked Isaac, my contact in the village, how many kids are there in the village under the age of 10? He said about 150. So I wanted 150 of these. So every kid opened one of these. I did a campaign where I got 75. Did well, that's half the village. So to send it over there, I had to send a pallet this time, which is like, you know, I sent 10 big boxes with these, packed full of these, okay. So to get to Uganda, it's expensive. You know, I had to go through UPS, it gets to Uganda, then it's got to pass custom, then you've got to get it from the industrial main hubs of Uganda to the remote villages. It's quite a job getting it there, and it's quite expensive as well. But yeah, I did a Facebook campaign. A lot of people in the UK donate, people from Glasgow, down south, London, the Midlands. It's a proper national effort.
That's amazing. It's so,
you know what I mean? Really good.
I'm like getting shivers as I hear about it. Like I can just hear how lit up you are by it and how passionate you are about it.
Oh yeah, it's great. It's really good. And the kids that have missed out, I'm sending another box now. I think it's about 20 kids that missed out, and I've got the names of them as well. So every box has got their name on. And so it'll take me a couple of months to get to every child. But as long as I'm breathing, no child's going to miss out on one of these boxes in my village.
That's so amazing. And so if anyone listening to the podcast wants to contribute or support that, how can they connect with you?
Send me a Facebook. And the last time I did a GoFundMe link where people can go on, make contributions to help the cost of shipping.
Cool.
I'm hoping to set up a proper company. A limited company where people can contribute small donations, maybe a couple of bucks a month.
Mm-hmm.
So the more money that comes in, the business model would be, okay, it costs about £100 a box to get over there. If I raised £100 a month, okay, to fill a box up full of sweets and stuff, that's not expensive, probably 20 bucks, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It probably costs 120 bucks to send a £120 to send a box full of food and aid over there. So the more people that contribute, the more boxes I can send. I've got a daytime job, so I can do it in my spare time. No, every penny will go to these kids. It's not like Oxfam where they've got CEOs to pay and directors and sales execs and all kinds of reps on high salaries. You know what I mean? This is a proper every penny goes to the kids kind of thing. And I actually did audits for my campaigns as well, showing people how much came in and how much is spent on the shipping. So people knew every penny went to these kids.
Yeah, that's fantastic. That transparency where people really see where their dollar is.
Absolutely, yeah.
Kind of reaching.
And that's important. The transparency is important. So people will probably give again if they knew every penny is going to these kids.
Yeah, absolutely. And so it sounds like your life from like where you started until where you are now is just like such a tremendous transformation. Like you've just totally, like you just seem like you're thriving now.
Yeah, it's good times. I really enjoy my life and, you know, I'm like anyone else. I have bad days and good days, but it's a lot better than what it was when I was drinking, put it that way.
Yeah. And so if you had to give some advice to anyone that is struggling with alcoholism, anyone who is looking to get sober, what advice would you give? What would you recommend?
First of all, I acknowledge the power of alcohol, mm-hmm. how powerful it is, and surrender to it. Don't keep getting in the ring with alcohol. If it's beat you once, it'll beat you again. Use tools like AA. AA will cost you £1 a meeting to pay for the whole. Go to AA meetings. Go as many as you possibly can. If it's not for you, try something else.
Yeah.
If you fall off the wagon, don't give up. Remember, it took me 20 years to find a formula that worked for me. I tried to quit for 20 years and I kept falling off the wagon.
Yeah.
So don't think you're a failure if you've gone back to drinking. A lot of people give up, think they're not worthy and the self-esteem goes. And one thing you can guarantee, if you quit drinking and you stay sober, you'll be handed the keys to the kingdom, honestly. You can make life so happy, it'll be beyond your wildest dreams if you quit drinking and stick to it. Stay sober, stay away. Stay away from that first drink. Stay away from pubs and bars if you have to. That's what I've done. I go into a pub now to watch the football, and as soon as the football game's finished, I'm out the back door. I don't stay around drunk people. Mm-hmm. And as soon as people, if we go to an event, if it's to do with work or a wedding or a christening, as soon as I want to go, I go. Don't feel obliged to stay around drunk people. Find different things to do. Yoga, sport, go to the gym. No, there's other things to do than sit in a pub or sit in a bar.
Yeah. Wow, this is great advice. I got shivers when you were talking about, if you fall off the wagon, don't think that you're a failure, because I think it's so common that people can get into that headspace. You know, they have one night off and then they just think, you know, it's over, I'm done. And I see this happen often where people will kind of spiral in and out of, you know, having a sober streak and then having one drink and feeling like it's over. And I love those words you said about, you know, you're not a failure, get back up again, try again. Because I think that will resonate with a lot of people listening.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, when I first quit drinking for the first couple of years, I felt like the invisible man. I felt like everyone was ignoring me. I stopped getting invited to events because, you know, it felt like everyone else is enjoying themselves apart from me.
Yeah.
And it was a sad time the first couple of years. I needed to garner all my strength to stay off the drink. The first couple of years can be quite tough. I remember one time, this was the toughest time, okay, and I remembered it. One time I was working at a catalogue place. It was in the sales where it was a sales job where it was like a call centre. And we all went to meet each other in the town centre. It was a beautiful sunny day. Okay, and we all spent the day with each other, and there was a party on at night, and they were all talking about meeting up for this party, and I couldn't go. I had to get on the bus and go home, you know. And I saw what I really wanted to go to that party, but I knew I couldn't go. And that was a pivotal point, that, you know what I mean? That could have gone that way or that way.
Yeah.
Because if I would have gone to that party, I would have ended up drinking and I would. But that's the kind of things I had to do. I had to make decisions like that, strong decisions.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, expect a little bit of sacrifice. Expect some challenges. It's a rocky road, but if you come through it, imagine waking up every day looking forward to the day and trying to make a contribution instead of being scared of your own shadow.
So beautiful. Well, thank you so much, Graham, for being on the show. It was so wonderful to kind of talk to you, to hear your story and get to meet you.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. And I'll put in the description of the bio, I can put a link to either, you know, your email or your any way to contact you if people want to get involved in your project for Uganda.
That'd be fantastic. Yeah, I've got quite a lot of friends on Facebook. I've got an open door policy with my Facebook friends. Anyone who wants to be my friend on Facebook, I'll welcome them. It's not a problem.
Perfect. So then maybe I'll just put your name on Facebook and then and find you there. I'm the same. I have so many Facebook friends.
Yeah, that's what it's all about, reaching out to people, open door policy, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. All right, thank you so much, Graham.
Super, Alex, thanks for having me on. You enjoy the rest of the day and hopefully we'll catch up again soon.
Sounds great. Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for tuning into this episode of Sober Yoga Girl with Alex McRobs. I am so, so grateful for every one of you. Don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss the next one and leave a review before you go. See you soon. Bye.